welcome to Season's Greetings to Taste. Happy Christmas, or by the time that I've edited this, Happy Easter. It's been a while since our last episode of Season to Taste. This is, I think, partly been down to the fact that we chose as our next story to watch a story we'd seen quite recently and actually wanted to leave a little time before we watched it again. Yeah. And also just because it's been the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who and we've been swamped.
Literally swamped.
And I think we didn't really want to add anything more to it at the time. But this is Season to Taste, and we are working through...
Season's Greetings to Taste.
This is... We've done it once, it's fine.
Okay. I thought it was going to be a thing.
It's not cool. It's not going to be a thing. But we are working through the 35 active years of Doctor Who, picking a story from each season. And so we aren't going to talk about Doctor Who and the time of the Doctor. We're going to talk about the story that we chose to represent Series 5. And that was The Enemy of the World. So, Matt, what did you think of Doctor Who and Everybody Hates Raymond? Well, come on, I thought that was good.
God, you Kent. It's probably a bit ungrateful, but I'd probably have preferred Philip Morris to find most other stories than The Enemy of the World that are missing. It's fine, I just found it drags quite a lot compared to, say, The Seeds of Death or other Troughton six-parters.
Really?
I think the first episode's really good and nicely directed, and I like the last episode, but like the middle bit, it's just like people sitting around in caravans for ages and ages and ages.
You mean the scene in the caravan that is one of the best scenes in all of Doctor Who? Do you mean that scene?
That's one scene out of many, many, many... Well, it's not just caravan, to be fair. It's like people's flats and... It's like a kind of bizarre six weeks of people going around to different houses and having dinner. It's like the kind of
Come Dine With Me
of the 1960s. They go to Astrid's flat and Giles's caravan and Astrid's beach house. And I
find it quite hard sometimes to tell which continent, which country they're supposed to be on. The accent's not helping a huge amount. But if it was Come Dine With Me, I'd give it a very high score.
And of course they do have a chef in it.
They do have a chef, Griffin, who's one of many quite good characters, I think, in The Enemy of the World. I really like it. It's my favourite story from Season 5. It was before it was recovered, in spite of received wisdom. And I was pleased to discover it was as good as I'd hoped in pictures. And there was quite a lot. The bits with the underground bunker I'd actually completely forgotten about from the audio.
But those are probably the livelier bits, although the fact that one of the... That their kind of young lead is called Colin.
It's hilarious. It's one of those things that probably sounded fine at the time when it was set 50 years in the future, rather than being set 5 years in the future as it is now. Mm. But yeah, Colin just is not a dramatic name for characters to have, it adds a level of humour to those scenes.
He does appear to be acting in a film from the 1930s rather than a 1960s TV series as well. He's very kind of, I must go to the surface, I can't bear it down here any longer, Angela.
Colin and Mary. Jesus' less famous parents.
Another Cub Diamond-y kind of reference.
Oh, I didn't like Colin's gazpacho.
acting.
I also love that I thought Colin was right. But I love that Colin and Mary, the other person who has a name down there, is called Swan. Like, is that your first name? Or are you an Eric Saywood surname person? Because Colin and Mary were teenagers when they went in the bunker, as it were. They're called Colin and Mary, but you're called Swan.
Well, maybe Colin's his surname.
Stephen Colin.
Philip Collins.
And Hail Mary. Yeah, anyway, I liked it, and I thought it was a nice change of pace. It's in a season which is, obviously we didn't watch it as part of that season, but in a season that's full of quite slightly repetitive Base Under Siege type stuff, and you know what the Ice Warriors is like, when we're talking about other six-part Troughtons that we might compare to, actually I think it's reasonably fast. Yes, there's a lot of talking, there's a lot of nice talking as well, and a huge amount that's lifted by Patrick Troughton's portrayal of Salamander, which is a joy in basically every scene he's in.
To be fair, I think that's the justification for the whole six episodes, is that Patrick Troughton in a dual role is worth watching, regardless of what else goes on. And I do think that lifts it. I think Series 5 is massively overrated. And, yeah, The Ice Warriors, I think I said in the last episode, is painfully boring to watch. And I think what lifts The Enemy of the World partly is the fact that it's by David Whittaker, and I don't think he writes painfully dull stuff. But I think what really lifts it and justifies it is Patrick Troughton playing two roles.
And he is, from the moment that Salamander first appears, he's terrific. And I love that scene in what I assume is Kent's office. You're right, I've slightly lost track of what's where. But where the Doctor is watching the United Zones.
Yeah.
I love that little satire. It's even like a picture of the United Nations, isn't it? Because the nations are now zones. It's the United Zones.
What did I ask you of the cornfields of the Ukraine? 15 bumper crops!
It's great.
It's brilliant.
But, and everything, not only Salamander's look and his accent, but actually in that scene, it's so like a politician. The way he gives that speech, it's so wonderfully observed.
I do think, though, they missed a trick that they didn't call the whole serial Suncatcher, because that would be such a perfect Bond title for a Bond villain, wouldn't it be? The Suncatcher!
The sun rays
at the cornfields of the Ukraine.
But it isn't a Bond, is it? I mean, I think it slightly wants to be. David Whittaker, I think David Whittaker tends towards these more human-led...
Yeah,
political thriller style. So even like the Rescue's a David Whittaker, isn't it?
And yes.
In The Rescue, there's a human villain. The Ambassadors of Death is about human villains.
I don't think he ever writes, apart from the Dalek stories that he's brought in to write, and later on the Cyberman story he's brought in to write, he doesn't create his own monsters. I think his first scripts, The Edge of Destruction, where obviously it's The Broken Spring, which is a very Stephen Moffat kind of thing to do. Then it's a human being disguised as a monster, which is one of the most hilarious conceits ever, that in a series where people go, oh, it's just a man in a rubber suit, it turns out it is indeed just a man in a rubber suit.
Yeah, and this is in the second season. This isn't even in, like, after 50 years someone doing that joke. They've got that down right away.
But he likes his historicals as well. He wrote The Crusade, and this feels more like a historical story than it does the kind of monster base under siege type affairs that Doctor Who had kind of got stuck doing over the last couple of years. So I think at the time it was probably a very radical departure from what people expected Doctor Who to do. There hadn't really been anything like this since, I suppose, The Faceless Ones, and even that had kind of monsters at Gatwick Airport for several, you know, 6-9 months, something like that. There had been nothing that was monster-free.
Even the first episode is very Avengers, isn't it? With helicopters and the like little
fight
scenes.
Well, it's just like
an
ITC serial, isn't it? Yeah.
But Astrid as well is a bit like an Avengers girl, having...
Yeah, and Farrier is as well. Those two female characters are both really, really strong.
The story as a whole has a lot of interesting, memorable characters. And although you get a bit confused in, you know, what's Bruce's job versus what's Bennick's job, you actually have in Bennick and in Bruce and in the Chef Griffin and in Farrier and in Astrid, in Federin and Dinesh, you've got quite... And Kent as well. You've got quite memorable characters, an interesting character, and characters who change through the story, who have very different motivations. You know, Bruce I really like as someone who's actually quite principled, and he works for Salamander, but he's not going to work for Salamander and support him if he finds out that he's actually really dodgy. Bennick is just brilliant, you know, that kind of Milton John's obsequious character that he plays in the Invasion of Time as well. But he's, you know, he's a horrible character, Bennick, and probably has the worst haircut in all of Doctor Who. But yeah, Farrier is great. And Astrid, I mean, Astrid is basically the companion in this story. By the time that Jamie and Victoria disappeared in episode 4?
I don't think they're in episode 4 at all.
Yeah.
And they're only in a bit of episode 5. And they're hardly in episode 6. Yeah. I mean, they kind of disappear halfway through.
I mean, Astrid basically, they have a lot of interesting stuff to do in the first half of the story. And then Astrid basically takes over as the companion in the second half of the story. And I think it's fair to say she is the best Astrid in all of Doctor Who.
Definitely. You've just pointed out something that I found really bizarre when I was watching it, which is that a whole episode goes by with neither Jamie nor Victoria in. You know, these days, obviously, it'd be unthinkable for an episode to go by, or whole episodes to go by, where the companions don't even appear, even for, you know, 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. But in the 60s, if everyone had their little holiday weeks, you know, the Doctor would be off for a week.
But I think one of the things that I found a bit dull about the story was those middle episodes, because I think in episode 3, the Doctor's only in it in that one scene that you really like, where he talks about the broken vase. And then the following week, Jamie and Zoe aren't in it at all, and the Doctor's barely in it.
Mm.
And it does feel like, for the middle two episodes, that they just focus on all of these other characters who I don't really...
They're interestingly drawn, but you're not...
Yeah, I don't really care that much about them. It's not really an adventure for our heroes, it's just... loads of other stuff happening.
It does it does kind of write the Doctor out for a little bit of it, and Troughton's in it, but he's playing Salamander. And so you kind of, as a viewer, you're like, well, I'm watching this and enjoying this, and I feel like the Doctor's in it because I can kind of see him on screen, but it's actually not the Doctor at all, it's Salamander.
And he's so passive in it. I mean, if you actually look at what the regulars do, because the regulars are the characters that I really care about, they turn up and have a bit of fun in episode 1, which is great, and they have an adventure in episode 1. Jamie and Victoria go undercover in episodes 2 and 3. That's interesting. Then, as I say, Jamie and Victoria vanish. But after episode 1, all the Doctor does, he impersonates Salamander 2 or 3 times, and then just sits in a caravan with Kent for most of the time. And at the end, he kind of gets Giles Kent to confess.
Well, he gets Bruce on side as well.
He gets Bruce on side.
And that's a lovely scene where he's pretending to be Salamander to Jamie and Victoria.
It is, but the point I'm making is that you're right. All of the things like discovering the underground bunker, that's Astrid discovers the underground bunker when she bumps into Swan. It's nothing to do with the Doctor.
She even gets
Jamie and Zoe didn't know anything about it. The Doctor never goes down there.
Astrid even gets the episode 5 cliffhanger when she finds out about it and meets Swan.
So I think it's really bizarrely done, and the regulars, and this is why, again, I think it's almost like a kind of Hartnell historical more than a more typical Doctor Who story, in that the characters are observers who kind of occasionally get drawn into things, but they don't. The Doctor's very reluctant to actually play any active role. He doesn't really want to interfere or get involved.
It turns out he's quite suspicious of Giles Kent.
Exactly. But it's really strange to see the regulars be so sidelined for such a big chunk of the story. And you're right that Astrid is a really good character and I really like her, but I just think it's a shame that David Whittaker couldn't have made it as interesting for Jamie and Victoria and given them something better to do.
Yeah, there are so many supporting characters that they get some good stuff in the first half of the story and then just vanish. I mean, they get the chance to appear in front of a lovely matte painting of an outdoor park in one of the early bits, because you have this lovely location footage and it's got all these different locations, but then you do get one of the dodgiest backdrops in all Doctor Who. I think it's a really well-directed story with Barry Letts getting the hang of fake backgrounds there ahead of his own era. They do have nice touches, like Victoria being terrified of a helicopter and neither of them having ever seen one before. One of the problems with having historical companions, and then them both just going, what's a helicopter?
Yeah. Actually, I don't think it's as problematic as I used to think, because clearly, you know, if
the characters
Martha and Rose go into the future, they have to have things explained to them, like teleports or whatever. So, yes, the Doctor gets a kind of funny line about whirly birds or something like that, but it's dealt with very quickly, and both of the, you know, Victoria isn't swooning around going, oh, but how can we fly, oh, it's the devil's work, or anything ridiculous. They just kind of get on with it and go with the flow. Actually, having watched this story, one thing I did get out of it was I came out of it liking Victoria more than I did going in. I've always thought Victoria was crap compared to Zoe, who I think of as my favourite Troughton female companion. And I've always thought Victoria's just a bit of a wet, weedy screamer. But actually, although she's very sidelined, in the bits where she is given something to do, she's quite impressive.
Yeah, she gets lots of fun stuff in those scenes with Griffin. And those, I think those are where both characters, both Jamie and Victoria, get the decent stuff. Is it in the European zone? Is that where they are then?
Yeah.
When they're in the big country house,
yeah,
and Jamie gets all the really clever stuff with the bomb plot, which actually works really well, and kind of getting himself into Salamander's trust, and Victoria dealing with the comedy chef, who's like Marvin the Paranoid Android. He is. he doesn't need to exist in this story as a character at all, but he does liven it up with his just terrible fatalism.
And she has posed as Jamie's girlfriend, and there's a kind of running joke, I think, in this whole series about Jamie having a bit of a thing for Victoria. I think in The Ice Warriors, he gets a line about imagining her dressed in their kind of weird figure-hugging miniskirts, and she gets very uptight about it. And she also goes to slaps who she thinks is Salamander, turns out to be the Doctor, at the end. And the Doctor goes, oh, no, you wouldn't hit me, would you, Victoria?
And he brilliantly falls off the chair. Was he supposed to fall off the chair?
I thought that's pretty feisty, isn't it? Yeah, she's about to go and whack a supervillain in the face.
I mean, meanwhile, you have a bit early on where I love that the Doctor, when the Doctor's looking at Salamander, and goes, oh, he's rather handsome, don't you think? He doesn't say, don't you think, Victoria? He says, don't you think, Jamie?
And Jamie chuckles. There's obviously a kind of, we're not really gay.
But also, actually, it helps prevent the Doctor be too flirty towards Victoria. Because if he'd said to Victoria, don't you think he looks handsome, that's kind of saying to his young girl companion, don't you think I look handsome?
Yeah, I mean,
it's much safer.
If it'd been Matt Smith, he would have gone, bit handsome, isn't he? And he would have winked at Victoria and then tweaked a nipple or something like that.
I mean, they'd all have been naked anyway, wouldn't they? People, and who should walk in but the vicar? But then you have the bit, which people have said the Doctor's really flirty with Astrid early on. I'm not convinced he's all that. You know, when he's saying, well, he's like, I'll do whatever you want, or I can't remember what the line is.
It's because Astrid says to him something like, I think you're perhaps the most wonderful man that's ever dropped out of the sky.
Yes, he's basically massively flattered,
and he just massively twinkles at that moment.
Yeah.
You can see, ooh,
but I think it's more his ego just going like, oh, this
of
is what I like, rather than the fact that he wants to pounce on her. And actually also, that line, there's the bit about where she says, you know, it could cost you your life. It's about putting him in a position where he's smiley and relaxed before he has to react to that particular shock. Yeah, we talked in another podcast, I think it was about Love and Monsters, where the Doctor says, you know, I'm a lot of things, but I'm not nice.
Yeah.
And actually, in The Enemy of the World, while he's being all twinkly, he says something like, I think I'm the nicest person you could possibly meet. He's changed his tune in the intervening thousand years.
Although, I think this is one of the stories where, if you watch this and then you watch the Three Doctors or the Five Doctors, you realise what a different character the Second Doctor is when he comes back in later stories, because in this, he's very suspicious of people. He's very merciless towards Salamander at the end. He's going to put him off the ship and he's going to be found and hunted down. It's almost like a David Tennant moment of ruthlessness, or a Chris Eccleston with Cassandra moment of ruthlessness.
But even then, he's had his big argument with Giles Kent about, you know, he's not going to take part in private justice and he's not going to execute anyone. And although Salamander goes flying off into the time vortex or wherever he is, the Doctor very much isn't going to do that. The Doctor's saying, you know, I'm going to put you outside and you're going to be dealt with the way you're supposed to be dealt with.
He says he's going to kill him. He says, he's just utterly pitiless. He won't offer Salamander any help. He just says, right, this is the mess that you've created. You're going to be put off my TARDIS. You can run wherever you want to, but you will be hunted down.
Yeah.
And you can imagine, you know, Eccleston or Tennant or even Matt Smith doing something very similar.
They're saying run to someone.
Almost like you can run, but you can't hide.
Yeah.
And that's a very Doctorish moment. I really like that.
Yes, but he's also massively playful in this story. I mean, from the opening bit where he goes running into the sea, and then comes running out of the sea quite dry. He's very playful, and I guess actually that's one of the interesting things about the character as a whole, isn't it? And also about Troughton's portrayal, is that you can have that steely moment at the end, and his steely moments when he's dealing with Giles Kent. You can have him cleverly mimicking someone else. You can have him bouncing around at the beginning, having a laugh.
Yeah.
And then you can also have something like that beautiful scene in the caravan where he's talking about the broken crockery and the line about people making nice things and other people coming along and breaking them. It's just one of the nicest lines the Doctor ever has. And you've got all of those different aspects in the one story.
Yeah.
And it's not because the character's confused, it's because he's a complicated, mercurial character.
I mean, for all that I said, I wish they'd found other stories. I'm very pleased, obviously, that I can sit down and watch The Enemy of the World, and it's lovely it's back. It's a shame that in the search they didn't find The Massacre, because I think it'd be really interesting to compare another evil double story and see how they handled The Abbot of Amboise and how Hartnell played that role differently and how he looked as the Abbot, but you know, we've always got the audio. So, yes, thank you, Philip Morris, and let's hope something else eventually turns up.
And I don't think he's really the advert to the... And it's as much of a plot thing as it is. This story is based around...
It's based around...
That duality.
I think it's based around Troughton's so good, let's give him something else a dual role, whereas I think The Massacre is based around, oh, how can we sideline Hartnell?
Here's a convenient plot thing we can do.
Yeah.
Let's talk briefly about the end of the story, because it comes to quite a rapid climax. I mean, I really like the revelation that Giles Kent isn't all he seems to be. I think it's another part of, you know, characters changing and being a bit different.
Yeah,
and
it's a nice, complex David Whittaker script where actually the Doctor's right not to just jump into bed, metaphorically, with Giles Kent, but to be suspicious of him. And I like the Doctor's line about anyone who's that quick to resort to murder can't be entirely trustworthy.
And I'd forgotten quite how, you know, as an audience, you see the Doctor leave, having been caught in the explosion, and his clothes will be quite messed up. You see him say, you know, I'm not going to come with you, but I'll just take me to the gate. And the next thing you see is someone in those clothes running towards the TARDIS. And yes, you can probably guess it's Salamander, but actually it could just as easily be the Doctor, and it'd be very easy as a viewer to think that is the Doctor going into the TARDIS, make the same mistake that Jamie and Victoria do. And so there's then the lovely moment of the Doctor appearing in the doorway, and then them having that fight. It's a really dramatic end, and finally they meet face to face.
Yeah,
and they do appear face to face, which is a lovely moment. But then, because of the nature of the serial nature of this season, when he goes flying off into the vortex, that is the end of the story, and it feels a slightly perfunctory resolution because we're used to, you know, they have the end and then they wave goodbye and they leave. But actually, it's leading straight into the opening of the Web of Fear, and so that's it. So it's slightly odd in isolation.
And they do, I think, in the Troughton period, they did do, maybe less than the Hartnell period, but in the Troughton period, they still definitely did segues between serials. Because obviously in the Dominators, the volcano,
Dulcus
is erupting and it goes straight into the start of the Mind Robber. So, you know, I don't think it's unheard of or that unusual for a kind of story to bleed into the next one.
And they've got no qualms about referring back and forward. I mean, you have the line where the Doctor talks about who mishears a disused jetty as a disused Yeti, which is a reference back to the Abominable Snowman, but obviously also helping remind you about the Yeti ahead of them coming back in the next story. When they don't know who Salamander is and Astrid and Giles don't believe them, he says, well, you know, we've been, let's say, on ice. So they're quite happy to...
And in the Ice Warriors, I think he says that they've been on retreat in Tibet or something like that. So they're... There are always lots of...
So stop trying to fit missing adventures into those gaps.
They're not canonical.
So in the context of the 60s story, it's a fairly natural ending.
Yeah.
But when you watch the story in isolation, it feels a little bit perfunctory. Although, you know, flying off into the vortex or wherever is certainly a big enough ending for this big villain.
He could come back, couldn't he?
He could. He'd still be out there somewhere. It's not the Time Lord's trying to get through the crack, it's Salamander. Doctor, who is that guy?
Dr. Uwe.
And there are some other moments I kind of spotted during it. Some good, some not so much. I think there's that quite unnecessary moment early on where Astrid says of the helicopter, it'll blow up moments before it blows up. I think we haven't forgotten. It's like the overloading dimensions in time. We don't really need to be told that we've already had the whole fear thing of the helicopter, let's just see it blow up and not ruin the surprise. It literally, she says, it can blow up, and next shot is the helicopter blowing up.
Yeah.
It slightly ruins that explosion. Yeah, the stuff in the bunker is really interesting. It's quite Operation Golden Age-ish, isn't it?
It is quite Golden Age.
But I love, when Salamander first says, oh, you know, because of the radiation and dying, because he talks like Papa Lazarou, I think for a moment I was genuinely going, oh, are you actually ill? Is this an interesting other dimension to your character? And then cut forward a little bit to him just sitting there smoking a cigar smugly. So he's got these poor people trapped. You go, no, okay, you are just a proper villain. I love his lift that he uses to get down to the bunker.
It's ridiculously over-complicated lift.
I love the fact that you have to get in horizontally only for it to turn vertically and then go down. You could have just got in vertically, put a door on the front. It would have been like any other lift. It's a lovely piece of set, and it's wonderfully convoluted. But you go just build a lift, normal lift. I mean, maybe the idea is if anyone gets that secret door open and finds it, they just think it's a bit of technology and don't realise it is a lift. But I think, you know, let's not overcomplicate your secret base. Just build a lift. Obviously, one of the things we found from this being recovered is that wonder that you wouldn't have got otherwise in the Telesnaps is the wonderful pram woman in episode 4. Just what, member of the public, just wandering past, pushing a pram as they're doing
very
the take.
Battleship Potemkin, isn't it?
It's, in fact, that needs the woman from Battleship Potemkin.
It's to say she just pushes that pram around.
And for 100 years. But yeah, I think overall, I enjoyed that it isn't the same as the rest of season 5. I like that, you know, that nice thing of Doctor Who doing different things, and in this case he decides to do a political thriller. And mainly I like Salamander and Troughton's back and forth performances. And so even though maybe it's a little long, if it hadn't had the underground bunker, I think you'd get to episode 4 and go, well, come on, you're stretching it out now. And it does push you off in a whole other direction. It is clearly holiday time for Fraser and Debbie. And so then those characters aren't as well served as they might be. I think it's an interesting, different story, and I really like it.
Yeah, I like it. I can't imagine it's going to be one that I come back to lots. I have that kind of slightly discontented feel that Philip Morris searched the whole of Africa and rather than finding the Power of the Daleks or you know, the Macra Terror or something like that, he found the enemy of the world. But let's look on the bright side. It is a joy to be able to see the Pram Woman and Barry Letts, who I've always said is one of my heroes of Doctor Who. It's lovely to have his first association with the,
and particularly
the series back
his,
and forth.
His direction later, particularly later on where he's directing things uncredited here and there, and maybe not getting the recognition, it's nice to see something that is, I think, quite nicely directed with his name on it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I enjoyed it.
Cool. Right, well, I'm going to switch on the randomizer and we'll find out what season to taste next.
That randomizer looks very dusty. We haven't used it for a while. I hope it works.
I'll whack it. If it doesn't, it'll be fine. Randomizer active. It's me doing the time controller girl from let's ask the randomizer which season to taste next. I note that we've still got quite a bit of Tom. We still haven't had any Peter Davison. So let's find out which season we will taste next. Oh, for the love of... Well, it won't be Peter.
Okay.
But we will be going back to the 1980s.
Oh.
It had to happen eventually. It is season 22.
Does that actually count as Doctor Who?
Well, as you can already tell, we're taking a positive approach to the next episode. So what we have to choose between are Attack of the Cybermen, Vengeance on Paros, Mark of the Rani, The Two Doctors, Time Lash, and Revelation of the Daleks. So, six stories from which to choose. Six, it's not controversial to say, all classics. We are not watching Time Lash.
I actually had a flash where you were going to suggest... Oh, I haven't seen Time Lash for ages.
But no. Nope.
I mean, Time Lash is egregiously bad.
Almost comically bad.
Like, they just thought, oh, let's just give up trying for this fortnight.
Doctor Who doesn't have a lot of...
To get to the end of
the
season.
That'll do moments, but Time Lash is certainly one of them. But we're not going to watch Time Lash. As for the others, I've kind of got pros and cons all of them. I mean, there's one big con. All of them, that they're not very good. But I haven't seen most of the others for ages for similar reasons. I'll go through them and just give you my instinctive thing. So, Attack of the Cybermen, I don't think we've...
I mean, it's quite well
done
made.
Done a Cybermen story, haven't we?
No, we haven't.
And so it's a chance to see, you know, Colin's kind of first regular story after the kind of bedding in.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
We've got Vengeance, which a lot of people cite as the best story of the season. A bit satirical, Martin Jarvis, Syl.
Yeah, the Doctor only murders Is there three people he murders in that one?
It's obviously got Ken from Howard's Way and Sheila Reid from Time of the Doctor.
He doesn't murder them, yeah.
He doesn't murder them. Mark of the Rani, obviously we've got Kato Rani.
God doesn't murder anyone in that
we've
one.
We've got Anthony Ainley.
Yeah.
So those are both pros for that. It's a bit of a history. We've got Charlie Hungerford.
Yeah.
Then
look,
there's
beautifully filmed as well. There's some lovely location filming.
Yeah.
This is the last series where they actually filmed things, so
we've got the two Doctors.
Only murders one person in that.
But also I think, you know, it's another Troughton story, so there's a good Doctor in it.
Yeah.
I know I do I find it quite fun, but mainly because of Troughton.
Although it's interesting, in that one, they turn the Doctor into a hideous and unlikable psychopath who just keeps eating gluttonously, is horrible to his companion, criticises his companion's accent, and then they do the same with Patrick Troughton.
I genuinely didn't see where that was going at all. You caught me off guard with that punchline.
And then I got off the bus.
28 I was. Always 28. Always 28. Anyway, then we have... We're not doing Time Lash.
I know it's like everyone knows it, but it is still the most hilarious coincidence in the whole of Doctor Who that it's an anagram of lame shit. I don't know which came first, but I mean, if any story was going to turn out to be utterly abysmal, it was going to be Time Lash, wasn't it?
Yeah. Most people watch with a scream. we have got... You got
most viewers depart.
Yeah. So, we've got Paul Darrow and young Stephen McIntosh in that, and some glove puppets. And then Revelation of the Daleks, Alexis Ayres and LeBron, another contender that people have for the best story of the season. Colin not wearing quite such an outlandish outfit. The Daleks back. William Gaunt. Quite a lot of good guest actors in it.
Yeah, the Daleks are in it for about 2 minutes, aren't they?
There's things to like about that.
It's hard, isn't it? I mean, how do you choose one of those six stories from the season that justified Doctor Who's cancellation? It's hard, isn't it?
I mean, none of them would be our Desert Island Who.
Well, I put them all on the desert island. I mean, I did ask Philip Morris if he would take them to Africa with him.
So we will be concentrating in the next episode of Season to Taste on finding positive things to say about whichever one
we
choose.
We will find the good.
We should set the rule that we're actually not allowed to say anything negative in the next one. It'll be 5 minutes long. And that'll be the bit where we choose the next one. I do enjoy The Two Doctors. It is the longer one.
Yes, it is the longer one.
But I do enjoy it. Mark of the Rani, I could do... Vengeance of Arras, I actually haven't seen for years. So I would be up for that. I kind of like Revelation, but I've seen it quite a bit. I think that and The Two Doctors have probably seen the most of those. Attack is just quite garish and the Cybermen are annoying. So I lean towards Vengeance of Arras, but I'm not very... or maybe Mark of the Rani.
The tree
won't hurt you. How can we not pick a story with the line, the tree won't hurt you?
The only one that I'm averse to is The Two Doctors, because there's a whole 3 episodes of it, whereas the others are only 2.
Mm-hmm.
I know, we always say length isn't an issue, but in this series it is.
Well, with 3 episodes, the story might just be big enough for both of us.
Yeah, after Christmas, though, you know. Far wrong. Whichever one you want to go with.
Want is a strong word.
I know. There are positives about season 22, I think.
I generally think the satire and stuff in Vengeance of Arras is interesting.
Yeah, and I think generally it's a lift from series 21, actually. I think it does look.
Mark of the Rani looks better than Warriors on the Cheap, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. But I think even Attack of the Cybermen, which is very easy to criticise, the awful cyber tombs and the Cryon design. But if you can ignore that rather glaringly, obviously bad issue, Attack of the Cybermen looks good. It's just. The script editor Eric Saywood, who unfailingly slags off John Nathan Turner.
Hang on. He slags off the producer, John Nathan Turner.
He says in that sly little way, which I find utterly abhorrent, I think Erixo is one of the worst things that ever happened to Doctor Who. I'm turning into Ian Levine here. But Eric Sayward never got to grips with the pacing of the 45-minute episodes. And it just, it doesn't quite work. Like, costume's just awful. I'm just, sorry, I was trying to find the good things about season 22. Anyway, Attack of the Cybermen has its good bits. Season 21 doesn't look bad, but I just think season 22, everything's just lifted that bit more. The direction's just that bit better. And apart from Time Lash, all of the stories look to have a bit more effort put into the visuals. And I think there is a bit of a sea change between season 21 and season 22, where the overall look of the series improves. But the stories are just, the script editing is just dreadful. And if you look at the two aspects, who was responsible for production, the look, the directors?
John Nathan Turner.
Who's responsible for actually getting the script into shape? The script editor, Eric Sayward. And of the two, yes, there's some glaring errors with the leading man and the costume, which have to be attributed to Nathan Turner.
To the producer, John Nathan Turner.
But the script, that's Sayward's fault, and he has to take responsibility for that. He has to live with that, as we do.
On the upside, he did uncover Pip and Jane Baker, so that's... that aside, which one are we going to watch? Varos? Mark? Let's make it one of those two, I think.
Oh, well, let's watch the Mark of the Ronnie, because it's so much more fun than Vengeance on Varos. It's got Anthony Ainley, it's got Kate O'Mara.
And Colin Baker's got poo on his face.
Colin Baker gets shit on his face.
As if any better reason was needed. We'll be watching The Mark of the Rani. So join us in about 9 months' time when we've got an end to that. For a happy autumnal episode of Season to Taste. Bye!
Oh, bye! You should just cut it on. You go... Cut it.
what do we say at the end of the episode, Matt?
But...